remember Puddin' being openly critical of me and my life. Puddin' had been friends with Bobby's great aunt in the Rosenwald building. There was a lot of history there. I knew in her day you stayed married regardless of whether you were happy. "He's not so bad," she said of Bobby, as though that should have been good enough for me. Judy had told me when I was really ready to divorce, I would not care what anyone thought. She was right, and I did not. But I loved Puddin' dearly, and her initial reaction stung. "I'm sorry, Puddin'." My mind was made up. Seeing my expression, Puddin's tone softened, and she reassured me that even though she disagreed with my decision, it was mine to make. If she felt disappointment in me, she certainly never showed it. But I was disappointed in myself. From Northfield Mount Hermon to Stanford to Michigan Law School to my promotion in the Corporation Counsel's office, whenever I applied myself, I'd always been able to achieve what I wanted. Effort led to success, but no matter how hard I tried with Bobby, I couldn't make it work. We divorced the following year in the summer of 1988. It took me quite a while to realize that my failed marriage didn't make me a failure. Accomplished women are often asked, "Can you have it all?" If you think having it all means having everything you want all of the time and doing it all yourself, the answer is no. But with luck, life has many chapters, and each stage has unavoidable trade-offs. If we take each chapter in turn and embrace it fully, our decisions and their consequences, the joy and the pain, then yes, when we reflect back over the arc of our lives, they were whole, complete lives. But I didn't know that at the time, and by expecting that I could be a perfect wife, a perfect mother, and have a perfect career, I set myself up for disappointment. Staying up until 2 in the morning making baby food from scratch, while trying to be a successful associate at a high-pressure corporate law firm, I only wound up disappointing myself and others. I had created an expectation of myself no human could meet. One Saturday, I was trying to unlock the garage door while juggling grocery bags, purse, and 2-year-old Laura. The door kept closing on me. A man walked up and pleasantly asked if I needed a hand. "No," I snapped. Clearly, I did need a hand, but his offer made me feel pitiful and needy. I became so angry, I even teared up. Over a guy offering to open a door? He hit a nerve in my core sense of competence. Managing every task myself was tied to my definition of independence, yet I also yearned for a husband to take care of me. The last time I saw Bobby was in 1992, when Laura was 7. Bobby had moved back to Chicago in 1988 after completing his residency in Michigan, but by then he'd found someone new. By the time we were officially divorced, she was pregnant, and soon afterwards they were married. He lived only 2 miles from Laura and me, and yet we never saw him. Neither of us reached out to the other. In an effort to shelter Laura from disappointment, I didn't pressure him to make plans that I knew he would cancel. One Christmas, he made a plan to see her, but when the day arrived, Bobby never called. Not that day or ever again. And neither Laura or I brought him up again until almost a year later, in November of 1993, when he suddenly and unexpectedly died. My mother received the news from her sister, who had heard from a mutual family friend. My mom tracked me down in City Hall, where I was in a meeting with senior staff in the mayor's office. As I rushed home to tell Laura, I wondered how to break the news. I had so many feelings of guilt. I'd often fantasized that Bobby would disappear. I never wanted him dead or physically injured, just to somehow magically vanish from my life. Now that it had come true, I felt awful. But my real anxiety came from trying to figure out how I was going to tell Laura, who was now 8, because I knew there was no good way. I thought perhaps she would mourn the final loss of any chance of reconciliation. She cried, but that was it. 3 years later, my cousin Anne Marchant, whose biological father had also abandoned her at an early age, told Laura that she hoped Laura didn't blame herself for our divorce. Why would I do that? Laura replied, puzzled by the question. Anne and I smiled. Laura had tremendous confidence and self-esteem for a girl who'd grown up without a father, and though I take a fair share of the credit, my dad had a lot to do with that. After Bobby left, my dad told me, I will step in and be the father, and I will never disappoint her. And he never did. He drove her to and from school nearly every single day, even after she could drive herself, always arriving an hour before school let out in order to be one of the first two or three cars in the pickup line, so that she'd see him the second she came out those school doors, and she'd never wonder if he was coming. Looking back, I know that part of the reason I married Bobby was that I thought I could make him into my father if I just tried hard enough. Attentive and adoring, my dad set a high bar, often in stark contrast to the other men around me. I loved my father, but during my childhood, we'd rarely spent much time on our own together. My mom was always there, too. In 1977, the summer before my senior year at Stanford, while I was studying overseas at the campus at Clifton in England, my dad said to me, I want to be the first man to show you Paris. So we met there when he was coming back from a meeting in Nigeria. I offered to make the hotel reservations, and hearing my mother's frugal voice in my head, I opted for a 2-star hotel. After meeting at the airport, my dad and I pulled up to the place I'd booked, and I could tell by his expression that he wasn't thrilled with the accommodations. It didn't get any better once we were inside. The lobby had a strange odor. The beds in our room were so close together that I had to crawl over his bed to reach mine, and the bathroom was down the hall. The next morning over breakfast, he said gently, "This is fine, Lally, but let's see if we can find a hotel closer to the places I want to show you." He chose Le Maurice, opposite the Tuileries Gardens, one of the nicest hotels I'd ever been in. We walked all over the city, stopping at the Louvre to see the Mona Lisa and shopping in chic boutiques. One night we went to the famous nightclub, the Lido, and on our last evening my dad took me to Maxime's, the restaurant featured in Gigi, one of my favorite movies. Paris with my dad was nothing short of grand, and so was the cost. When the trip was over and the bills started to come in, my mom made a rare long-distance call to me in England to say, I feel sorry for the next guy who takes you to Paris. I think that was always my dad's intention. I'll never forget the Lido or Maxime's or the Mona Lisa, but far more indelible was my father's delight in our time together. After my divorce, I had two realizations. The first was that I couldn't make anybody change, and the second was that I deserved a man as good as my father, which may be why I'm still single. Chapter 6. Change from the ground up. In the early 90s, any time you drove from the South Side into downtown Chicago on the massive 14-lane Dan Ryan Expressway, to your right you were exposed to the largest and one of the most notorious public housing developments in the country, the Robert Taylor Homes, named after my grandfather. The Robert Taylor Homes comprised 28 identical 16-story high-rises spanning a campus nearly 2 miles long State Street from 39th to 54th. Their sheer size and condition made them a high-profile symbol of a problem that existed nationwide. Crime-ridden, the Taylor Homes simply warehoused people who were poor without offering any of the services or resources necessary to help the residents move up the rung of the ladder to the middle class. With no federal, state, or local funding for daycare or education, economic development, job training, or counseling, its residents were totally isolated. The Robert Taylor Homes were built in the hopes of providing a better option than the dilapidated tenements from which many of the residents came. But as a result of flawed policies at the federal level, over time, the residents of these buildings became uniformly low income. And because of the deliberate local policies of racial segregation, they were predominantly black. The plight of public housing in Chicago and in other cities across the country was a failure on many levels. it was a failure of urban planners to understand what makes communities thrive and grow. It was our failure as a nation to confront the issues of racial segregation and poverty that we had created. But at its core, it was a failure of the government to serve the needs of all of its constituents. In 1948, the Supreme Court determined that racially restrictive covenants were unconstitutional. When that happened, there was a jubilant sense of liberation and freedom in the Black community. Gradually, those who could afford to move out of segregated neighborhoods like Bronzeville did. Left behind were neighborhoods that quickly became populated with only low-income residents, which lost both government resources and private investments in the process. Businesses closed, roads deteriorated, schools lost students and funding, and more, all because residents didn't have the political power to demand better. Even the Rosenwall Building, the grand apartments my grandfather had helped build and manage, began to fall into disrepair. There was no comprehensive housing policy providing reinvestment for the low-income Black neighborhoods that had been neglected, or for helping to stabilize white neighborhoods going through racial transition as Black families moved in and white families moved out. As chairman of the Chicago Housing Authority, my grandfather had championed plans that he believed would do exactly that. He viewed it as the government's responsibility to provide quality transitional public housing that architecturally blended into the urban fabric, indistinguishable from market-rate housing. He believed public housing should serve as a way station for those working their way up, and it should also be a place where people could access the services they needed to become self-sufficient, like job training, health clinics, and child care assistance. In 1950, after decades spent fighting unsuccessfully to create healthy mixed-income and racially diverse communities, when the city council refused to approve a plan to build public housing in any white neighborhoods, my grandfather resigned his position as chairman of the Chicago Housing Authority. 7 years later, while still fighting to secure the financing to turn the Rosenwall buildings into a co-op so that it could be restored, he died suddenly of a heart attack. After his death, the city moved forward with its ill-conceived plans for urban renewal, breaking ground on massive public housing developments. Then, in 1962, in what can only be described as a very cruel irony, 5 years after my grandfather's death, Mayor Richard J. Daley honored him by naming the largest housing development in the world after him. My whole family attended the dedication, and the adults had mixed emotions. The crowd was led by Mayor Daley through the brand new buildings and thought that they were cause to celebrate. But I overheard my mother and my grandmother murmuring to each other, "This isn't what he would have wanted," which confused me at the time. The mayor of Chicago kept mentioning my grandfather and the accomplishment of creating the largest public housing development in the world. Why were they concerned? As I grew older, my mother helped me understand that the Robert Taylor homes were the epitome of all my grandfather had stood against. Isolated concentrations of very poor people, warehoused with no support services, in buildings that literally stood out like sore thumbs in Chicago's landscape. Anytime we drove by the Robert Taylor homes, which was often, as they loomed high in the sky just a mile from our home, she would remind me that my grandfather's vision was to create communities with people of all incomes and races living together in safe, habitable homes. As a youngster, watching the nightly news with Puddin' in her little front room, every time my grandfather's name flashed on the screen, it was accompanied by a story about violent crimes in the public housing complex. On the 10 o'clock news, nothing good was ever reported out of the Robert Taylor homes. Nothing. Ever. I would look over at Puddin', wanting to change the channel to protect her from the pain. She would just close her eyes and shake her head as the name of a person she loved was associated again and again with tragedy. As my career in city government moved forward, the failure of the Robert Taylor homes loomed as large in my mind as the towers did on the horizon, and I grew determined to help fulfill my grandfather's vision. By the summer of 1991, I was still working in City Hall, but I had a very different job. The phone at my desk rang steadily, and I usually didn't even need to answer in order to know who it was. One afternoon, I picked up, and of course, it was the security guard down the hall. "Valerie," he said, "Mrs. Adams is at the front desk. Could you come out to help her?" My office was only a few feet from the front desk, so I popped right over, as I always did. I didn't know who Mrs. Adams was or what had brought her to City Hall, but I did know that there would be steam coming out of her ears, and that whatever her problem was, it would be mine to try to solve. By that time, I'd been working in government for almost 4 years, mostly behind the scenes in the Corporation Counsel's office, helping to structure and negotiate development deals as a lawyer for the city. Now, all that had changed. My career in public service had become a daily exercise in serving the actual public, dealing directly with constituents and addressing their needs as the mayor's deputy chief of staff, a position I could not have imagined myself in 2 years earlier when Mayor Richard M. Daley swept into office, replacing Eugene Sawyer, who'd been appointed mayor in the wake of Harold Washington's tragic death. Daley's election was particularly traumatic for those of us who had come to City Hall under Mayor Washington. I was still bruised from the racially polarizing campaign when Washington and Daley had run against each other 6 years earlier, and it was crushing to think that Daley would now be our boss. And, as with any new political administration, we knew Mayor Daley was going to bring in his own team. Nervous about who the new players would be and in what direction Daley would lead the city, we all did some major soul-searching about whether to remain in government, if we were even given the choice. The mayor's father, Richard J. Daley, had been mayor of Chicago for more than 20 years and was known for governing the city through the 11th Ward machine, operated under a patronage system that left most black Chicagoans feeling powerless. The big question, would the son follow in his father's footsteps or continue the progressive agenda of Mayor Washington? The city's corporation counsel, Judd Minor, who hired me, tendered his resignation immediately. Lucille Dobbins, my primary client, mentor, and friend, didn't believe Mayor Daley would ever be true to Mayor Washington's vision. She left after the transition to start her own firm and hoped I would join her. But I loved my job, and I decided I was willing to give Daley a chance. It was years before Lucille forgave me for staying. "You'll be compromised," she warned me. The pressure to leave was intense. Lucille wasn't the only one who thought I was a sellout for staying in City Hall. But Mayor Daley embraced Mayor Washington's relentless fairness and continued his legacy in several ways. Nearly every Saturday, Daley visited a different ward in the city to meet members of the community and listen to their concerns, including those who had voted against him and were predominantly black. Daley was brushed off in many places and downright booed in others, but he kept on showing up. It was a tribute to his character and resilience that he didn't hold a negative reaction against his detractors, but instead understood that it was a sign that he had yet to earn their trust, and he was determined to do it. And he did. Mayor Daley won the majority of the black wards when he ran for a second term. It wasn't just Mayor Daley's willingness to engage with his opponents that helped knit the city together. He also continued the progressive agenda started by Mayor Washington, including minority and women-owned business set-asides on contracts and efforts to diversify the city's workforce. Mayor Daley loved his father, but understood he was governing in a different time. I think that's why he worked so hard to showcase a new image of Chicago when he hosted the 1996 Democratic National Convention. He was determined to wash away the image of the police in his father's city brutalizing anti-war protesters during the convention of 1968. Over the course of his first 2 years in office, Mayor Daley was certainly not perfect, but he earned my respect. He also terrified me. I mostly saw him on television being gruff and impatient with reporters, and I never had any direct interactions with him. Then one day, in June of 1991, my beeper went off while I was in Marshall Fields. There was an underground tunnel from City Hall to the massive department store, so I often went there during lunch for a change of scenery and a little shopping. Recognizing the number as the mayor's office, I raced to the nearest payphone. Why would the mayor be paging me? His assistant, Mary Ellen, answered the phone. She'd previously been an assistant in the law department, and we knew each other well. Mayor Daly wants to see you. Why? Honestly, I don't know. Where are you? I'm in Marshall Fields. Run! I did just that. But by the time I arrived at the mayor's office, he was in a meeting. Sit tight, Mary Ellen said. I'll let you know when he's free. Sit tight? I'll call you when he's ready, she said, looking at me with genuine pity. I spent an agonizing 2 days sitting by the phone before Mary Ellen summoned me again. When I walked into his office, the mayor was reading a document. So you're Valerie Jarrett? He said, looking up from the desk. Yes, I mumbled. Good. I wanted to meet the person who's been writing all these memos to me. I had actually met Mayor Daly once, 4 years earlier, when he was still the state's attorney. We had been seated together at the dinner after the wedding of my childhood friend John Rogers. When I saw my table assignment, I asked John why he'd seated me with Daly instead of my family and friends. He chuckled and said, "One day he'll be mayor of Chicago. Be nice." I must not have made much of an impression because the mayor clearly didn't remember me. My colleague Susan Curlin and I were responsible for drafting detailed cover memos summarizing the documents prepared by the Corporation Council and sent to the mayor for his signature. But we never thought the mayor was actually reading our memos. Turned out he was, and he was impressed. After a bit of small talk and some questions about my family and my personal life, he asked, "Would you like to be my deputy chief of staff?" I stared at him in disbelief, and he stared back, waiting for an answer. I mumbled that I'd like to think about it. He smiled and said, "Take a couple of days." Then, without a goodbye, he began reading some document. I bolted for the door. After speaking with my boss, Kelly Welsh, I learned that the mayor had been doing more than reading my memos. His senior staff had been watching me go toe-to-toe with department heads on policy matters, and they and Kelly had recommended me for the job. I was flabbergasted. I wasn't sure what to do. I defined myself professionally as a lawyer, and I knew I was good at my job in the counsel's office. But after 4 years, the work was no longer very challenging. It was all well within my comfort zone, and I was becoming restless for a new challenge. But it would mean a different identity from a practicing attorney. After thinking it over and consulting my parents, I decided I could always return to law practice, so I took the leap, and I've never looked back. In very short order, I knew the job was tailor-made for me. From day one, I was included in the morning's senior staff meeting. It was a meeting that everyone in City Hall knew about, but it took place behind a cloak of secrecy. Nothing leaked out of that room, ever. All the important decisions were made there and then communicated on a need-to-know basis. I was now at the center of it all. From that insider's position, I also had one of the most public-facing roles in the mayor's office. One of my responsibilities was to help ordinary citizens solve their problems with local government, work many people would have found frustrating, but which I really enjoyed. The sheer volume of angry people who arrived at Chicago City Hall was considerable. They just showed up on our doorstep every single day. And they were always at their wit's end. People are usually upset before they pick up the phone to call a government agency to complain. So just imagine how irate somebody needs to be to take time off of work to do it in person. When Chicago residents showed up, so frustrated by the government that they had no recourse other than to try to see the mayor, it was my job to figure out what was the problem and how we could help. It might be a business owner who had spent months working with the licensing department to start a new business, only to find out that his location was actually zoned for housing, which required him to then find a new site for his business. Or it might be a property owner who'd received an exorbitant water bill and couldn't get a response from the water department as to why. We received complaints about abandoned buildings, underperforming schools, poor road maintenance, trees that needed trimming, garbage, rodents, you name it. The principal quality that my job required was an unwavering air of calm, no matter how heated the conversation became. Both of my parents were good listeners. They always took a rational, intellectual approach to finding solutions while also having empathy for the person with the problem, and I tried to follow their model. Some people just wanted to vent, and I would simply listen, respectfully, even if I had no magic solution to pull out of my hat. The constituents with whom I spoke might not walk away completely satisfied, but it was on me to try to help and to do so in a way that made them feel respected and heard. Very often, they were justifiably upset, and I used the therapeutic and analytical skills I learned studying psychology and practicing law to make them know that we cared and wanted to help them. Then I would always do my best to actually solve their problems, and, I hoped, send them on their way happier than when they arrived. It was in this role that I welcomed Mrs. Adams to City Hall on that hot summer day. She started off by informing me that she had to pay for a babysitter so that she could come down to City Hall, and sure enough, there was steam coming out of her ears. I took a deep breath, lowered my voice in the hopes that she would do the same, and said, "How can I help?" Mrs. Adams told me that there was an old, dilapidated, abandoned building adjacent to her home. It had not been boarded up by the owner, and some drug dealers had set up shop inside. There was a constant traffic of drug users in and out. There were needles on her front lawn, and her children were no longer safe playing out in front of their home. She had repeatedly called the city's non-emergency assistance number to report the criminal activity, but nobody ever followed up. By this point, her eyes were filling with tears and her voice had begun to shake. I put my arm around her and I led her out of the busy reception area and into my office. While she collected herself, I called the district commander for her neighborhood and asked him to have the building checked out. I also called the building department and asked that the building be boarded up securely that day and that its ownership status be checked to see if the building was eligible for demolition. I apologized to Mrs. Adams and I assured her that, as a mom myself, I understood how she must feel. I then sent her on her way, feeling empowered that she had forced us to take her totally legitimate concern seriously. And finally, I added her complaint to a list of items that I would follow up on in the coming days to make sure it was resolved to her satisfaction. What I enjoyed most about dealing with constituents directly was that I could see the tangible, positive impact that the government could have on their lives every single day, no matter how minor. I could go home each night knowing I'd made a difference, however small. I would have preferred to stay in the job longer, but fate had other ideas in store for me. As I responded to Mrs. Adams and so many other Chicagoans who were unhappy about how the city was delivering services, I started brainstorming with David Messina, the mayor's new chief of staff, about how we could reorganize government agencies to make them more consumer-friendly and efficient. David and I were promoted at the same time. He had previously been commissioner planning and one of my clients. Together, we came up with the idea of combining a number of departments, including planning and economic development, as well as parts of transportation and housing, into one new consolidated department. All too often in city government, agencies contradicted one another, which frustrated constituents who fall victim to turf battles and conflicting policies. That leads to wasted time and money. The Economic Development Department, responsible for attracting and retaining businesses, didn't communicate with the Planning Department, which controlled zoning. Or neighborhood redevelopment groups working with the Planning Department didn't have the reality check or resources to make their plans viable, so they would wind up sitting on a shelf. Our goal was to provide a holistic approach to help businesses, community groups, residents, and aldermen work constructively with a coordinated government. In October 1991, David and I presented the mayor with our idea for this new department, the Department of Planning and Development. We included a budget, an organizational chart, and the candidate we recommended to head it up. The mayor nodded approvingly as he examined our proposal, made some tweaks, and then essentially signed off on the entire proposal for the department. The only recommendation to which he didn't react positively was our choice for commissioner, which disappointed us both. We had spent a great deal of time on the selection process, we both knew the candidate well, and we thought he was perfect for the job. Then, the next day, a colleague said to me, "You know the reason why the mayor didn't sign off on your recommendation, right?" "Why?" "He wants you to do it." My first thought was, shoot, I should have given the department a bigger budget. My second thought was that I didn't want to leave the job I already had. Deputy Chief of Staff was the perfect job. I had a lot of authority and little responsibility for day-to-day management. Plus, I'd been there for only 4 months. I'd barely unpacked my boxes. Unsure what to do, I scheduled breakfast with a very wise lawyer and family friend, Earl Neal, who represented the city of Chicago and was a valued advisor to every mayor since Mayor Daley's father. I told him about my predicament, and he said without hesitation, take the job, explaining that a staff role, where I advised, is very different from line management responsibility, and that I would never establish my own reputation until I ran my own shop. "What about the fact that I just started in my present position?" I asked. "Opportunity rarely knocks at the opportune moment," he said. I agonized for several days, but ultimately said yes. I became Chicago's first commissioner of the Department of Planning and Development, and I spent the next 4 years presiding over, as the New York Times later described it, a rancorous but largely successful makeover of the city's landscape. Rancorous would turn out to be quite an understatement. Among the many issues I faced in my new position, the legacy of problems caused by redlining and residential segregation were a top priority for me. The neighborhoods torn apart by white flight needed to be revitalized, and Chicago's public housing was in a dire state. By early 1991, there was a growing consensus at the local and federal governments that the dilapidated large-scale public housing developments were a failure. While I was still Deputy Chief of Staff, Vince Lane, the chairman of the Chicago Housing Authority, approached me to help him develop a comprehensive public housing redevelopment policy. Recognizing that large portions were badly deteriorated beyond repair, he wanted to create a strategy that would include demolishing all the city's large-scale housing developments and replacing them with mixed-income communities. He knew my family connection to the Robert Taylor Homes, and I assured Vince I was willing to help him. We began the planning then, and I continued to tackle this challenge when I became the commissioner of the Department of Planning and Development. 41 years earlier, my grandfather had resigned from the Chicago Housing Authority over the city's refusal to build integrated public housing that would knit the city together and help low-income people pull themselves up. Now, as the head of the newly minted department, I was in a position to fulfill the dream that my grandfather never could. But first, I had to figure out what on earth I was doing, because I was practically starting from zero. I was a 34-year-old lawyer who'd suddenly gone from co-managing a staff of 40 to overseeing more than 200 people merged from several different departments with different missions and objectives, many who had never worked together before. For the first time, I regretted sleeping through the GMATs my senior year of college. If I had taken it instead of staying up and partying the night before, I could have earned a joint graduate degree in law and business, and then I might have had a clue how to manage this new office. Instead, I was left to make up my own rules based on what I learned from being managed by others. My first rule was to listen. I had observed managers over the years who thought they knew all of the answers and ignored the advice from everyone on their team. Since my team knew I had no formal training in urban planning, there was no point in pretending. So I started all my senior staff meetings by asking them to brief me on what they were doing so I could learn as much as I could. Rule number two was to be responsive. I knew from the complaints I heard in the mayor's office that far too many citizens felt ignored by city government. For the first 3 months, I returned every phone call I received the same day. I plowed through all of my mail, often taking files home and reading late into the night. After I had tucked Laura in bed, I was so proud that I was taking care of all the incoming communications myself, but it slowly began to sink in that I had not affirmatively moved my own agenda forward. I was so busy reacting to everyone else, I had nothing to show that reflected my priorities. Rule number two needed some help. Elvin Charity once again came to the rescue. He said, "You need a chief of staff to keep the trains running, and I have the perfect person for you." He then introduced me to Beth White, describing her as a gem. From our first interview, I knew Elvin was right. She exuded quiet confidence, and her gentle southern accent disguised a will of steel. She wrestled my mail and stack of messages away from me, prioritized my day, helped me manage my team without her own agenda, and enabled me to make timely decisions, even working long hours after I went home to see Laura. Find and hire the right people, then, would be rule number three. Beth's presence gave me the space I needed to think through how to implement the mayor's agenda, as well as develop my own. Rule number four was to have a proactive agenda, not to simply react. It was a challenging time, not just for me, but for the city as well. Chicago's manufacturing base was shrinking rapidly as companies looked for expansive green grass suburban locations where they could spread out, free from the environmental concerns that came with old multi-story manufacturing sites in the city. At the same time, the 90s were the start of the comeback of American cities, which had been blighted in the 70s and 80s by disinvestment that led to soaring crime rates and fiscal crisis. Chicago was on the cutting edge of that national trend. It had a broad employment base, not dependent on any one industry, and as a result of the efforts that began under Mayor Washington that continued into the 90s, Chicago enjoyed a bustling central business district with theater, restaurants, hotels, and a night scene for young adults. During my 4 years as commissioner, the population began growing as people started to appreciate the benefits of living in a thriving city, especially the short commute. We had an ambitious commitment to attract investment that would spur revitalization and job creation. One day, early in my new position, Mayor Daley called me into his office and said one word, "Trees." I looked at him, waiting for the rest of the sentence. "Trees," he said again. "We're going to plant trees everywhere." I was trying desperately to keep manufacturing from leaving the city, and he was talking about trees? Good grief! It took a while, but I began to see that he was right. What Mayor Daley knew was that for neighborhoods where no one had invested in beautification in recent memory, trees were a transformational symbol of positive change. He planted a whole lot of trees all over the city, and they helped bring back neighborhood pride and spurred investment. For as long as I could remember, there had been a stark contrast between the landscaping on North Lakeshore Drive versus South Lakeshore Drive. Mayor Daley changed that, and those of us who lived on the south side noticed. We appreciated not only the appearance, but also the symbolism. We mattered too. Mayor Daley also made less visible improvements, including rehabilitating the city's 100-year-old water and sewer system, an initiative whose wisdom I appreciated when Flint, Michigan, experienced a contaminated water crisis at the end of my time in the White House. The state of Michigan and the city had deferred maintenance on Flint's water system for so long that it became a serious public health crisis. Mayor Daley understood the importance of upgrading Chicago's water system when nobody else was paying attention. One of my primary goals was to start making municipal investments in neighborhoods that had long been ignored by government and business to reverse their historical decline. A relationship I built with a West Side community organizer who led his neighborhood's revitalization planning process had helped me think through the organization of my new department and find the right strategy to support redevelopment. The original concept behind our new department was that by bringing together various agencies, all with different functions, we could holistically target a neighborhood with a vast arsenal of tools in our toolkit. To do this, we created a program called the Strategic Neighborhood Action Program, SNAP, which I considered the gold standard of the new department's mission. It shaped the way I view the role of government at all levels to this day. Instead of providing funding in traditional silos, my department planned with community leaders, and then we targeted resources from various departments, including housing for demolition, rehabilitation and new construction, transportation for resurfacing of streets, parks to beautify open space, and economic development to attract business. SNAP allowed us to comprehensively address the needs identified by neighborhoods, as well as to attract private investment. First, where should we direct this arsenal of tools? We put out a request for proposals that required strong local support from both elected officials and community organizations, as well as assets that made redevelopment attractive. Initially, we selected three neighborhoods to pioneer our approach. The first, not surprisingly, was on the west side, since it was the model. But the one closest to home was in the North Kenwood Oakland neighborhood, just blocks from where I grew up. When we moved from Madison Park in 1968, our new home sat between 49th and 50th Street on Greenwood, a short two blocks away from 47th Street, the dividing line between the neighborhoods of North and South Kenwood. Growing up, I was never allowed to cross 47th Street. As a young girl, the rule confused me. I was given a wide range to roam if the direction was south, but not to the north. It was unsafe, was all I was told. As I grew older, the invisible barrier troubled me. How could one street be the difference between safe and unsafe? What I understood by the time I became the commissioner was that my grandmother had been prescient when, upon leaving Bronzeville, she chose the area adjacent to the University of Chicago in South Kenwood. While our neighborhood had safely integrated and stabilized, thanks to the progressive political forces at work there, North Kenwood, not having those resources, had cratered due to white flight. Banks wouldn't lend, investment dried up, businesses moved out, properties decayed. The once thriving area became another struggling, low-income black neighborhood, yet another casualty of America's refusal to deal with issues of class and race in a constructive, sustainable way. By the 1990s, in contrast to the manicured affluence of South Kenwood and Hyde Park, North Kenwood had become a neighborhood of blighted buildings, pockmarked streets, and empty, overgrown, garbage-strewn lots. 70% of the land in North Kenwood was vacant, and half the vacant land was owned by the city. Many of the buildings were abandoned, but much of the architecture was gorgeous, and the community was right by Lake Michigan, a short 15-minute drive from downtown. Removing these invisible barriers that were stifling equitable investment and opportunity north of 47th Street and all throughout the city became my cause. I believed that North Kenwood had tremendous potential, and the community leaders had many constructive ideas about how to bring it back. But great ideas do not materialize without the leadership necessary to turn them into reality. So began the arduous process of crafting a plan with local leaders and residents that would be embraced by the whole community. The local alderman, Tony Preckwinkle, also my alderman, and then years later chairman of the Cook County Board, and, as of this writing, a leading candidate for mayor of Chicago, was and is one of the most effective leaders I've ever met. She ran an open and transparent planning process, and she tried to bring together divergent perspectives and drive towards consensus, lifting up committed residents to help lead the effort. Her partner was Shirley Newsom, appointed by Mayor Daley to the unpaid chair of the North Kenwood Oakland Conservation Community Council. Her day job was as an administrative assistant to a federal judge. Shirley spent countless hours in the evenings at community meetings and fielding calls from her neighbors until late into each night. She was well-respected by her neighbors and strong enough to manage conflicting, passionate views. Still, change is hard, even with the most effective leaders on board. But when it happens, it makes public service feel so worthwhile. It's impossible to undertake public projects of any magnitude without encountering serious disagreement, frustration, resistance, and always fear. Years of experience have taught me that the key to successfully navigating those challenges is to stay committed to true north, not perfection, but simply the greater good, and never turn from its coordinates. The hardest part, even harder than being the object of everyone's rage, is staying on course while recognizing some may inevitably and unfairly suffer in the process. My deputy, Kelly King, worked closely with Alderman Preckwinkle and Shirley to craft the redevelopment strategy, including creating an extensive preservation plan for the many historically significant 19th century mansions still standing, although barely, in the neighborhood. We also didn't want to displace the residents who already lived there, so we financed affordable and public housing that would have disappeared if development were driven completely by market forces. We created toolboxes with federal tax credits and free city-owned land for housing and commercial development with a low-income component and capped sale prices while still giving developers a reasonable return on their investment. We couldn't save every house the local conservation advocates wanted to protect, and we couldn't give the developer the profit margin they had originally demanded, but everyone received just enough to build a broad consensus supporting the plan. Still, despite the buy-in from the community leadership and major community organizations, the public meeting where we presented the plan was an unmitigated nightmare. It was held in a local Park District community center with a couple hundred people packed into its largest room. There were contentious questions and even hollering, but not by the people who actually lived there. Organized rebel-rousers and outsiders had come to disrupt the proceeding and stir up fear about gentrification, a legitimate concern, but that night used as a trigger word designed to provoke animosity and resistance to change. The actual residents who lived there had come looking for answers to their questions and to have a conversation. Many of them were legitimately afraid of change. The low-income residents were worried about displacement. Both white and black low- and moderate-income homeowners were highly skeptical about spreading public housing units throughout the community. And everyone wondered if the city would really follow through on its commitments, and even if we did, would the plan actually work? It was my first experience coming under strong attack by the very community I was trying to help, and at the time, it shook me up. I naively used to think people would automatically trust me and my motives. After all, I'd left a high-paying job in the private sector to dedicate myself to being a public servant. But as my parents often said, life isn't fair. They also added, who told you public service was easy? A painful lesson, but one that helped me endure more vicious attacks in the White House. As commissioner of the Department of Planning and Development, it was unavoidable that I would anger residents, developers, community groups, and elected officials across the board. I learned that many of those I was trying to serve had been severely disappointed in the past by my predecessors. "I'm from the government and here to help you," are fighting words to a lot of folks. Trust takes time. Trust takes effort. Trust takes building a record of delivering on promises. And it's a two-way street. Some officials were promoting their own self-interest, and I was simply in the way. A member of the city council once explained to me that with elected officials there were no permanent friends and no permanent enemies, only permanent interests, and that I should stop taking criticism so personally. It took time, but I learned to do just that, absorb the pain, a skill that would come in handy many times over the years. Eventually, we were able to bring most of the North Kenwood community on board. The redevelopment plan moved forward, and I learned several valuable strategies for making progress in the public sector. The first is that the community, including the elected officials, must feel that they have been heard and that their concerns are taken seriously. The second is that everyone has to feel a win, not 100% of what they want, but a tangible victory for themselves, or if they are in elected office, for them to deliver to their constituency. Third, everyone has to leave the table at least a little bit unhappy, for that's compromise. That there was a give and take, and the process was fair. In other words, you rarely hit home runs. You're more likely to get base hits. Yet over time, they add up. The success of the North Kennewick-Oakland redevelopment was far from my doing alone. It took dedicated local leadership and strong citizen participation. It also took 25 years. When I drive through the neighborhood today, I see mixed-income housing, architecturally significant buildings that have been restored, great parks, successful charter schools, and a resurgence of new and relocated businesses, including my favorite neighborhood restaurant, the original Pancake House, which relocated from South Kenwood, a true sign of progress. Most of the land that was vacant, that had been owned by the city, has been redeveloped. It's a neighborhood where anyone would choose to live, and I never give a second thought to crossing 47th Street anymore. That invisible barrier is gone. Once I found my bearings in the Department of Planning and Development, my only regret was that my grandfather, Robert Taylor, hadn't lived to see what I was doing. A man before his time, he had a passion for strong and vibrant communities, for people of all incomes. He knew that healthy neighborhoods were, are, and always will be the cornerstone of a great city. Creating jobs is vital, but without affordable housing, good schools, paved streets, safe parks, and places to shop, people can't live and raise their families with grace. Vince Lane and I joined forces with Daniel Levin. Daniel was the chairman of a private real estate development and management company, the Habitat Company, and the receiver of the Chicago Housing Authority, responsible for all its family development. That included the demolition and redevelopment of Chicago's many public housing developments, such as the Robert Taylor Homes. It was my chance to both right a historic wrong and do right by my grandfather's legacy. What made such massive efforts possible was a program from President Clinton's Department of Housing and Urban Development known as HOPE 6, or the Plan for Transformation. HOPE 6 gave municipalities the resources needed to tear down these large projects and replace them with humane mixed-income housing. We worked with the local communities to plan the redevelopment of these huge tracts of land and to address the creation of new mixed-income housing that would include homes for residents being displaced. Focusing on areas we thought had potential for market-rate developments, we started with the Cabrini Green Homes, a study in the stark contrast of the city. These high-rises where so many residents suffered under every epidemic from gun violence to unemployment to drug addiction were only a short walk from Michigan Avenue's Magnificent Mile in the heart of Chicago's affluent Gold Coast. In rapid succession, we also identified other good candidates for demolition, including the Henry Horner Homes near the United Center, a sports arena and big economic engine, and the lakefront properties, high-rise public housing buildings in North Kenwood, Oakland, with spectacular views of Lake Michigan. Our goal was to spur the redevelopment of healthy communities with low-density public housing woven into the fabric of the neighborhood, indistinguishable from market-rate housing, improving the schools and parks, and attracting other new amenities. Under the Gautreaux Consent Decree, we were required to achieve economic integration and ultimately racial integration. Even though these projects were in horrendous condition, they were still people's homes, and we were asking the residents to move. Some couldn't get out fast enough, but there were many who just didn't want to leave, no matter the deplorable condition of the buildings. People often resist change, even change that promises to be for the better. Many residents of Chicago's public housing had long suffered from institutional racism at the hands of the government responsible for supporting them. After generations of mismanagement and bad policy, their skepticism and fear were entirely understandable. We had to convince them to trust us, and the process was both challenging and controversial for everyone involved. But by sheer force of will, we kept the process moving ahead. Cabrini Green was torn down and replaced by low-rise mixed-income housing that included a school, a new park, and a large commercial development. In the case of Henry Horner Homes, We reduced the overall number of units by more than half and integrated the area's low-income tenants with new residents who were working and middle class. The lakefront properties were literally imploded in less than 5 seconds, and the new housing continues to be built according to Shirley Newsom's conservation plan. For all of these new developments and several more, we set up screening criteria for occupants, just as my grandfather had done in the Rosenwald buildings and the Chicago Housing Authority. Those who didn't meet the criteria were not offered the right to return. This involved lengthy negotiations, often among competing lawyers representing the residents, but we were determined not to recreate horizontally what we had torn down vertically, a place where law-abiding residents were plagued by gangs and violence. We also had criteria for how the new units should be maintained. Because the city's housing authority had historically shown itself to be incompetent and corrupt, taking bribes for repairs and not making them at all, the consent decree also required the new housing to be managed by private companies. By my 4th year as commissioner, we still had not begun the redevelopment of the Robert Taylor homes, but the planning was well underway, and it was becoming clear that it was time for me to move on. David Messina, the mayor's chief of staff, had been my protector through the formation and early days of the Department of Planning and Development, but he had left to become commissioner of the Department of Aviation. I'd angered more than a few of the city's major developers over the years. Remember, everyone has to leave the table a little bit unhappy. And without David to have my back, my job was growing increasingly unpleasant. It was turning into politics, not public service, which wasn't why I had gone to City Hall 8 years before. I thought about my options, going back to the private law practice, maybe teaching. Then a good friend, Marilyn Katz, suggested I move across the table and go work for the Habitat Company. She thought it would be a good match, especially since Habitat had been tasked with so many new responsibilities with these large redevelopments coming online. I would have the best of both worlds. I would work in the private sector, but continue my public service by redeveloping Chicago communities and improving the lives of residents of public housing. In return, Habitat would benefit from having someone with my experience in law, planning, and the political process as the company embarked on these large, complex public projects. Since I already knew and respected Daniel Levin, I thought it was worth exploring. Marilyn reached out to Dan, and a few weeks later, after several conversations, he called to offer me the job of executive vice president. I was thrilled about the prospect of continuing the work I cared so much about and receiving a private sector salary just as Laura's lab school's tuition was escalating seemed like a great deal to me. I resigned as commissioner on October 3, 1995, incidentally the day of the verdict in the O.J. Simpson trial, and left City Hall to start the next chapter of my life. Over the years that followed, the plans we'd set in motion at the Department of Planning and Development began to come to fruition. One day, in 2007, after I'd become the CEO of the Habitat Company, and not long before I began traveling nonstop for the Obama presidential campaign, I received a call from Terry Peterson, the CEO of the Chicago Housing Authority. He called me because the last building of the Robert Taylor Homes was slated for demolition, and he had a question. "Has Laura ever been to Robert Taylor Homes?" he asked. "No," I said, "she hasn't. We're about to tear down the last building. I want you to bring her in for a tour so she can see it. And there's somebody I want you and Laura to meet." So on a cold winter day, I took Laura and her best friend Maud to visit the last high-rise at the Robert Taylor Homes. Maud, who was working on a master's degree in urban planning at the University of Pennsylvania, was curious to have a closer look at the Robert Taylor Homes, about which she had studied in school. We walked into the lobby and saw the elevators were broken, so we climbed the dank, dark, and narrow stairwell. The strong stench of urine lingered in the air, even though the building was largely vacant at the time. When we reached the second floor, Laura and Maud didn't say a word as we walked around the barren gallery-style corridors exposed on the outside with iconic penitentiary-like wire mesh covering the open space. There was an eerie silence as I looked down at an empty playground, trying to imagine what life had been like for the children who had lived there. Terry knocked on the door of an apartment, and an elderly woman answered. She introduced herself as Mrs. Jamie Jefferson. Walking into her apartment, I felt like